lords of darkness, rulers of the earth, kings of the underworld, I command the forces of darkness to bestow their infernal power upon me.
Sein ist die Hand, die verletzt.
Sein ist die Hand, die verletzt.
Sein ist der Ort genannt Hölle.
Sein ist der Ort genannt Hölle.
May the black powers of our forefathers make us strong.
Hail. Hail the lords of darkness.
Welcome back, everybody, to the X-Cast. The truth is in here. I'm Tony Black, your host, and this week we are covering the 14th episode of the X-Files second season, Die Hand, Die Verletzt. Now, hopefully I've said that properly, because it's one of those episode titles I've spent years going, have I said it? Do I say that right? There's loads of X-Files like that. And I'm joined for this pretty memorable X-File, once again, for the first time in Season 2, Season 1 previous guest star Wayne Talbot. Welcome back, sir.
Thank you for having me, sir. It's great to be back.
It's great to have you back. You last appeared on the episode we did for Miracle Man, I think, in Season 1. So you've picked a better one here to come back on for.
Yeah, I mean, I think third time is the charm, because the first two episodes I did, they were all right, but this is a good one. This is a good episode.
It is. It's some quality. Yeah, because you did Genderbender as well, didn't you?
I did, and I didn't mind Genderbender. It was like, you know, it's very dated at this stage, but it for its time, it was one of those episodes that kind of make you go, huh. Like this one, when I rewatched it, this one recently, I was like, yeah, this is holding up. It's not too bad. It's it's still a 90s TV show, but it's still a good episode. The message is still there, like, you know, so
it's one of my favorites from the second season, so I've been looking forward to getting into this one. Before we do, what's been going on with you then? Now, there's been a lot of things happening on the Irish scene, hasn't there, this last year or so?
The Irish Pubcast is the main podcast that I do other stuff on, my co-hosts Kieran and Darren, and we've been very busy of late. We've got a lot of stuff happening, and we're doing a lot of live events, panels, and like we host panels and do Q&A's and things at the Dublin Comic Con, and the very first Kerry Comic Con, or K-Con, which is happening at the start of April, and we'll be hosting panels at that, and hosting the cosplay contest as well. But we've been very busy on that end, and also I've been busy on my own work as well. Like, I've been putting together my first ever graphic novel that I've been working on as a writer. But the first issue of it was released a couple of years back, and then it was halted because the comic book label it was with were kind of waiting for certain things to happen to fall into place, and they took 2 years to happen. So I got impatient, and I was like, look, I need to get this book finished. So that's going to be released in August. I've been working on that with a very talented artist called Brian Corcoran, and I'll be writing it and doing the colours on it. And then there's a letterer, Miriam Aboon, is also going to be lettering that for me as well. Brian has taken over from artist Rory Coleman, who drew the first issue, and I'm taking over from colorist Timothy Brown, mainly because it's like I want to get into that. Like I'm able to get to that level where I'm happy where I can color work. So yeah, it's been very hectic, but fun and a great learning experience.
It sounds brilliant. Yeah, it sounds like there's so much cool stuff going on in Ireland and for you. What's the graphic novel called then?
It's called The Broker. And it's kind of like it's kind of a commentary on the world we live in, and the kind of the social media and how people perceive information and how they receive information. But at its core, it's mainly about a guy who's just bad, and he likes being bad, and he does bad things just for the sake of, well, not for the sake of doing bad things, but he does bad things because it gets him what he wants, and he's under no illusion that he's, you know, there's that old saying, like, everyone thinks that they're here in their own story, but this guy knows that he's the villain, but that he's happy, he's made peace with that, and he knows that he has to be the villain in order to get what he wants, and he's part of a bigger thing as well. So it's kind of a mixture of, it actually, there's a bit of X-Files in it, because it's the whole conspiracy theory thing, and you know, the Men in Black and all that type of thing. There's a bit of that mixed in with it and stuff. So it's the first part of it was released as part of an anthology called Lightning Strike back 2 years ago now at this stage at Dublin Comic Con, and it was very well received. So I had the story written. It's been the scripts have been done. It's 3 issues all collected together, 30 pages, and it's been written and done for the last year. And a bit fully, like boxed off. And I was able to go to an artist that I met in Leeds, Topable. And I met him there. I was going through his thing and going through his portfolio with him. And I was like, look, I've got these scripts. Would you like to see them? And he's like, yeah, he's a gander. So I emailed him to him. We talked back and forth over email. He's actually an Irish artist. He's living here in Ireland. And he was just, both of us were over there for that weekend. And we'd actually, we talked to each other on Twitter a fair bit before we met in person for the first time. And a fantastic, his name is Brian Corcoran, fantastic artist. I reckon he's going to do well for himself, not even just off the back of this book, but he's going to do well for himself because he's fantastic. He came 6th in 2008's Talent Search this year at Topable.
Awesome.
Out of 200 people, so he came 6th. Wow. So it was like, I was lucky to get him at the point where he was at, and I'm hoping that he gets noticed through this, because he deserves to be noticed. He's a fantastic artist and a lovely fella as well, really nice dude. And just like Rory's a great guy as well, and himself and Rory as different art styles, but they both got the story, they got the idea behind it, they kind of were willing to go with it and work on it. And it looks fantastic. Brian is on Twitter. I think his Twitter handle is at Brian Corcoran, or Brian_Corcoran, and if you follow him, he's been tweeting over the last couple of weeks, the last month or so, he's been tweeting like his finished pencils of some of the pages and stuff for the book, and as soon as he inks them, then I'll be colouring them. So yeah, that's pretty much going to take up my next couple of months up until the end of July, when the book goes off the print, and then it'll be available 12th of August at Dublin Comic Con.
You headed me off there. I was about to ask that. So yeah, the broker, 12th of August, guys.
Yeah, it will be available. I will try and arrange for it to be available online as well, or even to order a copy of it, depending on how many I get printed and how popular it is and how well it does. So we'll see how it goes.
That's brilliant. Well, we'll give it a bit of a promote on air on these circles, because it sounds brilliant. And if it's a bit X-Filean as well in places, then people who listen to this might want to pick that up. So yeah, keep an eye on that one, guys. That's fantastic. Also, keep an eye on our social media feeds if you haven't been following them, because there's lots of stuff going on with the X-Cast as well. Make sure you check us out on Twitter at the X _cast. On Facebook, the Facebook page, just type in the X-Cast, and you'll also find the group, if you look for groups, the X-Cast Podcast Fan Group, which has got loads and loads of conversation in there, loads of chatter. So don't miss all those. And also, you know, if you can give us a like and a review on iTunes, that'd be brilliant. That'd help us out, because you'd love us, don't you? You love us. You love listening to us. Make us even bigger by helping us out. So with that out of the way, let's press on and let's talk about what we're here to talk about, which is Die Hand, Die Verletzt. Die Hand, Die Verletzt is the 14th, as I said, episode of the second season of The X-Files. It originally aired on January the 27th, 1995. It was written by Glenn Morgan and James Wong. It was their last script before they left the show to go and make Space Above and Beyond, their spin-off series. And they eventually came back in season 4, of course, for a little spell, but this was their last episode for season 2. And it was directed by Kim Manners, the first ever episode directed by the legend that was the late, great Kim Manners, who arguably would say, Kim Manners went on to be, alongside maybe Rob Bowman and Chris Carter himself, one of the greatest, if not the greatest, director of The X-Files over the years. So this is a pretty awesome debut for him. The story sees Mulder and Scully arrive in a small town in New Hampshire, Milford Haven, when a teenager is ritualistically murdered, and they begin to uncover a satanic conspiracy which may go to the very heart of this very peculiar town.
Take a look at this. I found this on the internet. The discovery yesterday of a mutilated teenage boy in the forest has police officials distressed about the possibility of a conspiratorial organization of dark forces.
Where's that pulled from? A local paper?
The Jew is known to remove organs and sacrifice teens in their religious ceremonies. It's taken from Völkischer Beobachter, a Nazi newspaper in 1934. The rumors are the same, but the blanks have been filled in with whoever must be feared or persecuted at the time. In this case, it's a cultist.
Modern witches, known as Wiccan, are a religion. They have a great reverence for all life and nature. They do not cast harmful spells. They don't worship Satan. Even the Church of Satan has renounced murder and torture. Their influence here wouldn't account for the frogs or the water draining backwards, or most importantly, the murder.
Well, if not witches, then what?
So out of 10 then, Wayne, what would you give Die Hand I Verletzt?
Okay, I don't mean to be this guy, right? But I'm sure there are people listening to this and they're probably screaming at you. But I think it's pronounced Die Hand Die Verletzt.
Oh, more than likely.
If my German serves me well, I think that's how you pronounce it. Because D is the female, with the German language, it's der and D. And I think it's Die Hand Die Verletzt. So to get that annoying bit out of the way, I'm sorry for that. But out of 10, I would give this episode a solid 8.5.
Yeah, why would you go that? Because that's pretty high. So why would you go there?
When I was rewatching it, I remember seeing this when it aired here in Ireland, and I was thinking, this is kind of it's that high school horror thing, like, you know, before the main big high school, it was throwback to 80s high school horror type stuff. But then it started to get into the visual aspect of it, like, and there were particular scenes in it that it actually got applauded for and criticised for that I loved as a horror fan. And you don't see enough kind of this type of horror, like demonic horror, in everyday TV sci-fi horror shows. Like, this is just, like, you have to remember, this is 1995. It was very rare to see this type of thing on TV, particularly in Ireland, because of it being satanic in nature. And sure, the church had never allowed that in this country. So it's a case of this happened and I got to see it and I was like, wow, it hit me. And watching it again there recently, it kind of came back to me why I liked this episode so much, because it was slightly taboo for me as well.
Ah, yeah, yeah. Of course, because Ireland is an extremely religious country with a, well, it certainly has an extremely religious, you know, history. So it never occurred to me, really. Were there any cuts made, you know? Did they chop anything out?
I remember, see, the thing about Irish TV, you have to remember, even though Ireland was, like, it has less and less become over the years, but it's still slightly controlled by religion in parts. But it would, you know, the influence, if you can remember, back in the 80s and 90s, the influence of the church was a lot more than it is now. But I don't think Irish TV wasn't as heavily censored as British TV. Because the old, you know, ITV cuts of films, you know, like the, you know, Yippee-ki-yay, Kemosabe for Die Hard and all that type of thing. That happened on English TV, but it didn't happen on Irish TV. We had a watershed, but we weren't too worried about it, you know? So the X-Files aired on Irish TV, but we actually got the British feed from BBC as well. So even though it did air on Irish TV, because every terrestrial TV station picked up the X-Files in its popularity, but I don't think it was ever cut on our air when it aired on Irish TV. So we got the full scenes that happen in this episode, which are graphic for their time, not so much anymore. But they did get a lot of criticism for those scenes as well.
Yeah, it's really interesting, because it is quite a satanic horror episode. It's almost like, in a way, I almost think it's like the X-Files does Hammer horror. It's got a certain element of camp, weirdly enough, this episode, which even though it's really quite dark and quite sinister, and it's also quite funny, and it's all intentionally quite funny.
Yeah.
And it knows how overblown and dramatic and in many ways silly it is. So there is that element of sort of horror, old school horror camp about it, and I love it for that. I think it's really impressive for that fact.
I think the opening scene kind of lays that groundwork, because the opening scene is like PTA meeting talking about what the school is doing over the next couple of weeks, and they're discussing what play the kids are going to put on, and they're talking about Jesus Christ Superstar, and with the tongue firmly planted in the cheek, the parents say, I don't think that's the right kind of play for this school. And the school is like Crowley, as in Aleister Crowley High. So it definitely wears its heart on its sleeve as an episode. But the parents had no problem with them doing Grease, you know. But their one complaint about Grease was it has the F word in it. So, you know, yeah, I mean, it definitely did understand what it was trying to do, and when it was tongue in cheek horror humor, it was definitely there. And then when it wanted to be full on horror, it did also went down that road as well. You know, I mean, I actually have a terrible phobia of rats, and there is a scene in the episode quite early on that contains it's a jump scene where there's rats, and it literally, I squirmed. So
you've hit on a really good one there. Obviously, Aleister Crowley being the very well-known English occultist in the 19th and 20th centuries, a very strange and fascinating character who many have said was into some serious black magic weird shit. Basically, to put it in a very, very, very basic term, if you dig deep into Crowley, there is some fascinatingly mental stuff there. And he's obviously inspired a lot of fiction over the years, and there's been lots of things done with that. So there's a very heavy nod to that occult element to it. The name Mrs. Paddock, who obviously is the ostensible villain, we ultimately find out. The name Paddock comes from Macbeth, oddly enough.
Yeah.
And she, in Macbeth, Paddock is the toad demon that calls the witches away in the very first scene of the play. So there's Shakespearean allusions as well as occultist allusions. And obviously Macbeth is full of occultism, you know. It's full of witches and prophecies and, you know, definite sort of dark, you know, undertones.
Yeah.
So there's the as I say, there are plenty of things like that. The title, which you happily corrected me on, because I need to pronounce this right. Do you know what it's called in? Do you know what it translates to in German, Wayne?
I don't know.
It's translated. It's part of the chant that the PTA meeting say at the beginning. And I'm going to try and pronounce this right. Sein ist die Hand, die verletzt, which means his is the hand that wounds. So die Hand, die verletzt translates as this is the hand that wounds, ultimately, which is an interesting title, an interesting choice. And I need to find out, potentially, and some people may know this, whether or not that chant is real. It's some kind of real satanic chant, or it's something they made up. I don't know. It'd be interesting to find that out, really. So there's a lot behind this, but I think it's done in such a fun way, in such an enjoyable way, in such an enjoyably entertaining way, that you can almost watch it without all these interesting allusions and things like. You don't have to go down the rabbit hole with that. You can enjoy it as a horror piece, can't you? It's quite a, you know, fun, scary in many places horror piece. Chris Carter described it as a cautionary tale about playing with fire, playing with things bigger and badder than you might imagine. And it all came from an original idea of Glenn Morgan's to have a scene where a snake eats a man. So that obviously, which obviously is the key, one of the key horror moments where Jim Horsbury gets eaten by a by a snake, which we'll get into later. So they started with that really interesting visual image, and they went off from that, really, and came up with some all kinds of batty shit, which is really fun. But I think I would agree with you. I think I'd give this an 8. Maybe 8 to 8.5. I think I'd agree with that mark.
For one of their earlier, like, I mean, I know it's the second season and all, but the Monster of the Week, like, episodes, which extensively the show pretty much has been up to this point mostly. They were slowly but surely building on the mythology within the actual show, but the Monster of the Week stuff, some of it had fallen quite flat and some of it hadn't. And this is definitely one of the ones that definitely did not fall flat. It worked because of how it ends. Because it's kind of, it had that option of revisiting that kind of idea. It seemed to be precursor to a lot of things on a lot of other shows that came afterwards. Like, in the way it handled itself with the writing, with the characterizations, the whole lot. Like, and funnily enough, if I'm not mistaken, the blonde girl, goes on to be an actress who is in The Faculty.
Yeah, Laura Harris. She was a major character in the Faculty. She's also in the second season of 24. I think she was a baddie, if I remember rightly. It's not afraid to dip its toe into different areas. You know, we've talked about the horror. It's not afraid to be funny. It's not afraid to have lots of cracking Mulder one-liners. And Morgan and Wong, I think, are the best at those. They know exactly how to get David Duchovny doing one-liners. It's just perfect. They're not afraid of that. They're not afraid to embrace the overblown, you know, neo-gothic nature of it all. They're having fun. You can tell they're having fun. It's fun in the writing while also being pretty freaky and disturbing and dark. They very skillfully managed to do a lot of things in one episode. To me, it also feels a bit like a precursor to what they did on Millennium in the second season of Millennium. Where,
yes,
they balanced a lot of these things in that. They balanced a lot of occultism, they balanced a lot of esoterica, they balanced a lot of comedy in many ways, in some respects, even though that was a very much more dark show. They've got this ability to juggle these things, and I think Die Hand, die verletzt is one of the best examples of that. On IMDb, this episode has an aggregate rating of 8.3 out of 10, out of 2,574 votes, which, you know, is a pretty good grade. You know, it's up there with Irresistible, which we of course did very recently. It's in the top area of the second season, although it's beaten by a fair few episodes. You know, so I think that's pretty good. I think that's a pretty good aggregate, really. I think it fits roughly where we've placed it. So I think most people tend to think that Die Hand, die Verletzte is a pretty great episode. So this will be fun. Let's explore this one in more detail. So the episode begins, as we talked about, with the PTA meeting. And as you mentioned, Wayne, you know, they're talking about the not having Jesus Christ Superstar. What I think I liked about this was the fact that there's this real juxtaposition with this of a very ordinary sort of parent-teacher association meeting where they're just talking about, oh, the game's on in a bit and, you know, what are we going to put on? What's the school play going to be? And then suddenly they're like, they've got candles out, they're doing a satanic chant, and they're coming out with some quite clear anti-Semitism, which comes up, you know, a little bit later with the it's really I love the way it changes. At first it seems a very mundane meeting, and then by the end you've got this door, this brilliant, it's almost like Kim Manners putting his mark down straight away with that great shot of the door with the candlelight behind it, the chanting, Mark Snow's music, and the pull away. Fantastic shot. It goes from really mundane to creepy as fuck in like about 2 minutes.
It does.
That's pretty great, don't you think? I mean, that's a pretty good opening to the episode.
It is. And it actually lays as well. They lay the kind of groundwork in dialogue saying that they've lapsed in their prayers. So they're kind of like, they're lapsed Satanists or lapsed satanic worshippers. They, like, one of the guys is like, oh, I just want, like you said, he wants to go catch the game. But one of the other fellas is like, look, we haven't done this in a while. We need to, you know, get our shit together and start worshipping the Dark Lord again, and, you know, because there's consequences if we don't do this type of thing. And yeah, it's kind of, I think that is, it's a juxtaposition of like, I think it was part commentary on Catholicism as well, or even just in religion in general, where people tend to pick and choose what they like about it and then use whatever they like about it to their own ends. And it's very much like the whole man-made thing. And they believe it's a man-made thing to a degree that they can lapse and there's not going to be... Well, some of them believe there's not going to be consequences, but there very well is.
The whole lapsed, you know, Satanist thing is one of the key... It's the complete flip side of, you know, a lapsed Catholic or a lapsed, you know, religious person. It's a twisted, inverted sort of version of that, you know, where they're all these dark rituals and these, you know, as you say, the Dark Lord, which makes me think of Voldemort straight away. but it's that whole... It is that whole inversion of what you expect. You know, you would expect them to turn around and be Catholics, all be, you know, in the middle of the American Bible Belt. You know, you've got these teachers, these very conservative teachers who are praying to a dark, evil, you know, satanic force. It's a brilliant inversion of what you expect. I thought what was also interesting was that you didn't get that was the teaser. The murder and the actual death doesn't happen until after the teaser. Normally you would get that scene that we saw, and then you would also get the death that would set up everything. But it doesn't happen like that. You actually then get the kids going into the woods and doing their chants, doing their really bad chants, just reading from a little piece of paper going, after what is that? Azazel. You know, I just don't know what they're doing. And then summoning up, you know, evil.
Yeah, it's kind of, it is strange, all right, that it is a different, there is a, like, you expect the drop to happen before the credits.
I almost think it's a better choice, sort of setting up the teachers as bad guys first, because you've got that there already. You know these guys are up to some weird dark shit, so you know straight away that they're baddies, that they're up to no good, and then the episode plays with that all the way through. I quite like that. Actually, it's quite cleverly done. I think maybe that's why they decided to leave that as just the teaser, because you've got that really good shot, as I say. Yeah, and it's just interesting, just on the talking of direction, it was, as I said, it was the first time Kim Manners directed an episode, but he wasn't the original choice. There was supposed to be another director helming this one, but that fell through and he was hired. But they were, believe it or not, they were worried that Manners wouldn't fit, oddly enough. He used to do a lot for Stephen J. Cannell, who did things like The A-Team and, you know, all that very cheesy, really good in many ways, but that cheesy 80s often stuff.
Yeah.
Cannell felt that writers and directors should work together to cast characters, look at locations, film the episode. But the X-Files crew didn't believe in that. They didn't think that that was the way it should go. But Glenn Morgan fought for him, apparently. got him onto the episode. And, well, it was the right choice. Because he went on to direct some of the best stuff in the entire show. So it's a good job he fought for him, really. So yeah, you've got the you've set up the murders anyway, and as you mentioned, you've got one point to make, just because I always point this out when I see characters who I see actors who appear in roles again. You've got a few people who crop up in this one who appeared in previous episodes of the show. So you've got Doug Abrahams, who plays one of the teachers. He's appeared. Funnily enough, he appeared in Genderbender. Actually, he's the guy who's he's the guy who's interested in like the game and the football more than the others. The guy with the mustache. He was a random agent, yeah, in that. And he goes on to appear. He also was in The Pilot, just played a patrolman in The Pilot. He also goes on to appear in Hell Money in season 3 and The Field Where I Died in season 4. So, and then he's in a couple of Millennium episodes. So he's a bit of a prolific one, actually. And also, the woman who plays Jim Ausbury's wife, so Dan Butler, a.k.a. Bulldog, from Frasier, who plays him, she was the lead sister in The Kindred in Genderbender.
Yeah, she looked familiar. I was like, I know that actress somewhere. I didn't bother looking her up. I was like, oh, I've seen her in things. She's probably just one of those character actresses that has like popped up in things.
She's a bit different here. She's a little bit more glam, I suppose, in the way she looks. But yeah, Michelle Goodyear is her name. She was funny. Isn't that funny? Like two people are in Genderbender, which you did. Isn't it weird?
Yeah.
But yes, there's a couple of callbacks there. Also, the guy who plays the sheriff, Sheriff Oakes, is Larry Musser, who goes on so memorably to appear in Osei Chung's From Outer Space as the swearing Detective Manners, the swearing detective. He's just one of the funniest things in that episode. You feel like talking to this blank hole? It's just...
Well, I suppose the X-Files does do that. It recasts a lot of the same actors over and over again. They've got like a troupe that goes with them everywhere.
I love it when they do that, yeah. And it's cool to pick out those people and spot them, really. One thing that is interesting right from the off is that Morgan and Wong are playing with this idea that the town is strange. That the town has a lot of inbuilt sort of legend and conspiracy.
Not the opening scenes, but when we first see Mulder and Scully arrive into the town and... they meet the kind of hapless sheriff who seems a bit out of his, like, he's out of his depth big time, and he doesn't really know what to make. He's basically feeding into all the kind of, I believe there's some satanic stuff happening in this town, but I really haven't got a clue. But yet I've grown up here all my life, but there's something dark about this. And like, Scully is kind of like, yeah, whatever, but you know, in your usual way. This is just a killing, you know. People do this type of stuff all the time to make you think that there's something satanic about it. Yeah. And again, she's her usual non-believer. And then when she says it to Mulder, he goes, well, you don't seem to believe him either. And he's like, no, I didn't want to feed into his obvious, you know, craziness. But yeah, I reckon there's something dodgy here. Don't you feel it? And she goes, no, I don't feel it. And then literally it starts to rain toads.
Yeah. Mulder, toads just fell from the sky. Maybe their parachutes didn't open.
Yeah. Brilliant. The one. But the look brilliant. On her face, though, like, it's for somebody who is not meant to believe at all at this early stage in the show, the look of complete disbelief when the toads start to fall, the look on Gillian Anderson's face is priceless. And Mulder's face is just literally one of very matter of fact. Yep, that just happened.
Yep.
And it's a great
little
scene.
This is the kind scene. Of place where that can happen.
Yeah, it's and really then even good. In the very next scene where they found it, Scully finds a scrap of paper in that scene that has the words "In America" as a title of a book, and it's a page ripped from the book, and it just has the arse end of the title that says "In America," and then they find themselves in the local library in the next scene, and Mulder's looking through all these different library cards to find the books, and he finds one that's like witchcraft in America or something like that. And straight away, Scully, her entrance to the scene is, "Let me tell you why those toads fell out of the sky. There was a tornado." You know, hundreds of miles away, yeah. And they picked the animals up and they landed here. So that's the reason why those toads fell.
Yeah, this is why. It's nothing weird, Mulder. It is a tornado. But there's a sense of mass hysteria right from the beginning, isn't there? You know, he's talking about, you know, kids listening to devil music and old stories in the past. You know, it's that whole feeling that they've bought into this idea that there is some great evil that is visiting itself upon the town when they fail to see that the evil is
and
the town.
And even the even the people that are the parents and the teachers that seem to be in the cult, they kind of feed on that as well to a degree.
Yeah, because they talk about, don't they, about later on when they talk about the great conspiracy that they're fighting, the great occultist. And it's sitting there, you're sitting there thinking of the irony, thinking, are you serious? You guys are. You are.
It's like, I suppose it's the whole thing of like, they're basically trying to deflect any blame from themselves by going, well, we're totally against all of this shenanigans. It's disgraceful, carry on. Who would do this type of thing? I blame the metal. Yes.
Yeah. This is it. It's directing the blame at the wrong places.
Yeah.
All the way through. And it's really interesting how they immediately get this sense that, you know, with these kids dying and everything, that there's something externally evil going on. And it is that whole idea, really. There's just as I say, there's loads of great lines. There was a great Mulder line where they're talking about the altar, and Mulder mentions with a few cans, it'd make a good coffee table.
A few cans of lacquer and a picture of John Wayne.
Great
on my coffee table. Yeah.
Oh, I love that. It's a great line. Then we get to the school, we get to Crowley, and we meet Mrs. Paddock in a very sort of almost background way. Firstly, you know, you wouldn't almost notice she's there. She's just a teacher. She's an old teacher, an old woman. Yeah, whatever. But you've got, and because it's that classic misdirection, this episode, isn't it? Because you've got your eye on the PTA group, because we know that they're into some dark shit. So they're whispering and going, one of you killed him. One of you did it. And at this point, you're thinking, yeah, it's got to be one of them. But they're all saying, well, no, because like, we're not doing that stuff anymore. But you don't, I don't know about you, when I first watched this, I didn't think Mrs. Paddock. I didn't think, that's weird. It's very cleverly done, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's very much misdirection. Like, the whole point, like you said, it's meant to be misdirection. You have this idea that these four teachers or four parents are like evil incarnate, but I think the whole time, personally, when I rewatched it there recently, I was like, these guys are just wimps. They're not like full on satanic ritualist people at all. It's like Paddock is there to teach them a lesson, to say, you guys think you're bad? Let me show you who's bad. And it's a case of they haven't got a clue. It's the whole thing about they chose parts of the religion that served them well. But the sacrificing and the, you know, the kind of the ritualistic sex and all this type of weird shit that you're led to believe they're doing, they're not actually doing.
And I think what's really interesting about this episode as well is that it taps into a lot of these very American kind of fears that were there all through the 20th century, you know, and it goes back to things like, you know, the fear of commies and Reds at the door and all this stuff, and Jews and all these occult, all these conspiracies that a lot of traditional conservative sort of Americans, they externalized a lot of these, you know, with all these different things. And it's talking about, this episode is very much about that idea that they're externalizing a lot of these fears when, and you know, there's that scene where they're talking about the great vast occult conspiracy.
Yeah.
And Scully makes the point that, you know, if this was really happening, thousands of people would be dying a year and nobody would catch these people. And then they turn around and go, well, this is what we're up against. And they're like, it's the whole thing with the FBI as well, the FBI being in on the conspiracy. And I think that's great because it's talking a lot about how America has sort of mythologized a lot of this stuff over the years. And this episode is there to show you that as much as, yeah, they, you know, there's all these conspiracies within the very conservative sort of belt of America in that they've tried to externalize, Mrs. Paddock turns up, as you rightly said, to say to them, there is some proper dark shit out there and you better not piss me off.
Exactly, yeah. It's like they're like, it's like, if this is what you want to worship, then, you know, you got to pay the piper type thing, like, you know. And yeah, it's a case of you worship properly or else don't worship at all. And I think that's the case of that, where the whole juxtaposition of differences against religion in general, like that, it's saying like people are kind of lapsing in a way that they're getting very lackadaisy about their beliefs. And yet when their beliefs come home, when those issues come home to roost, it's Paddock basically. And, you know, they need to pay up. And I think it's done very well because there's no rhyme or reason to Paddock. She's just there to teach them all a lesson.
Yeah, this is it. You don't get to know her as a character. You don't get to know what she, it, whatever she is thinking. She's purely there as a force to punish them, almost. And the interesting thing that I noticed throughout the episode is that Paddock never, ever actually hurts. She doesn't hurt Mulder and Scully in any way, like ever. At any point of this episode, she doesn't target it at them. The only people who suffer are either the PTA guys or people around them who get sucked into their orbit. Except perhaps the Jerry Stevens, the kid who's killed at the start, possibly. But he's still in the school, I guess. But it could be, again, that he tried to piss about with all this stuff. And she rose up and, you know, and taught him a lesson. As if to say, don't mess about, kid, because there's some really dark shit.
Yeah, show some respect, basically.
Yeah, exactly. And then this is the thing. It's that whole kind of classic sort of worship idea, isn't it? It goes back to like the old days, you know, thousands of years ago, where people had to believe in gods and they worshipped gods. And if they didn't, then they would either be sacrificed or they would be punished for the lack of worship. It's like the inverse of that in this case. If you're going to, like you said, if you're going to worship something dark, then don't take the piss, because this is real and this actually exists. And I think that's great. It really, like you said, it's a cautionary tale. Chris Carter said it. But I love all that. I love how much it's commenting a lot of this stuff all the way through and drawing links in with anti-Semitism, with occultist conspiracy, with distrust of the government. You know, these people, they don't trust the government at all. I also really liked the fact that Mulder sees the water going backwards.
Yeah.
That's a little awesome little visual, isn't it? Of to show something strange is going on.
It's a very straightforward, basic special effect, but it was kind of like, yeah, this isn't normal. And even Scully is kind of like going, that shouldn't be happening. And she was like, oh, maybe that. No, there's no explanation for this. This shouldn't be happening. So it's like, there's definitely something strange happening in this place.
But again, though, that is one of the things, though, isn't it? One of those moments where Scully should believe more, shouldn't she? She should believe more that there's paranormal stuff. If you see Coriolis force being inverted, she can't possibly explain that one away, can she?
She can't science her way out of it at all. And she's like, no, there has to be a scientific explanation. Really? What is it? Tell me.
But it's all the juxtapositions keep happening. I love the moment where you've got the girls who obviously, you know, they saw their friend die and everything, and they're talking to Mrs. Paddock, and she's like, oh, if you need any help, you know, just come and see me. And they're like, thank you. Walk off, opens a drawer, there's a fucking heart.
Well, that's the kid's heart and his eyes, the one that's been sacrificed. She was like, yep, got it in my drawer. And she just plops the tests down on top of them. Plop. That's it, done. But I loved, like, I mean, the scenes that I mentioned earlier on, that for something back in the 90s on pretty much primetime television, like, I know it was probably after, you know, it was that post-Watershed, but it was still technically primetime TV. You had the pig embryo dissection.
Oh.
And, like, just even the build-up to that scene where Paddock is going around with a trolley full of pig embryos with the umbilical cord still attached, and she's just plopping them down on all the tables. And then she's like, right, extra credit if you dissect the heart. And then the scene happens that we've seen, it happens, you've seen in other horror films after that, where the embryos will come to life in some form. But the way it was done is that the pig was basically, the kid that's with the girl is like saying, look, I'll cut it open if you dissect the heart. And she's like, yeah, whatever. And, you know, she's kind of freaking out a bit. And then the heart starts beating and she goes off the rails. That particular scene got a lot of backlash, but got a lot of kudos as well for being so horrific. And I think that was one of the best pieces of horror early on in the X-Files.
There's loads in season two. I mean, it's I've talked about it many times on in this when we've done season two, but there's lots and lots of episodes in season two that have these really fucking scary images that when I was a kid really stayed with me. Things like, you know, in Aubrey, the cutting on the woman's chest, and the in Red Museum, you know, the crow flying at you into the screen, and Fresh Bones, which we've got coming up very soon, of the scene where, you know, Scully basically is choked by a voodoo hand and all this. There's lots of these really freaky moments. And this is one of the best. This pig, with the pig and then the scream as it turns. It's really creepy in the way it's done.
As much as that scene is visual horror, the scene that follows it, where the girl is describing what the ritualist supposedly did to her and her sister, is in itself more harrowing, because you're sitting there listening to this girl tell these horrible, horrible things to Mulder and Scully, and she's like, all of this, and she's distraught, and she's like saying, all these memories were repressed. I'm only remembering all of these now because of the murder. And the murder that happened at the start of the show is pretty much forgotten about at this stage. Like, a kid had his heart and its eyes ripped out. And yet, nobody was called into, you know, account for that. They were more interested about the occult as a whole than about the murder. And it's basically like the murder is like just a catalyst for everything else, obviously, that happens. And it's never a case of, you know, Mulder and Scully are out to get the murderer. They're out to find out who the actual satanic ritualist people are, following her little kind of meltdown. And then that kind of seems to be the MacGuffin for the rest of the episode, as well as figuring out what the hell Paddock is.
But it's taking you down the rabbit hole, isn't it, in a way? Because now, what is really interesting about this is that it lays your bad guys out from the start, really. You've got the PTA guys at the very beginning, and then once you see the heart in Paddock's desk, you know that she is obviously something dark and weird. And she's the killer. Well, you don't at this point know that she's like, you know, some sort of demon, but you know that she's the killer at this point of Jerry Stevens. So it lays its villains out. Mulder and Scully, we're one step ahead of Mulder and Scully at this point, and a few other people, in that it's as much about those villains and what they're doing and the way they're twisting everything and the way people see things as much as the investigation, which ties into Shannon, because I thought that the way that Paddock reacts when the pig is coming to life, she's staring at her, and to me, she's putting those visions in her head. And then the whole monologue, which is, I mean, it's brave to do that, because that's like nearly 5 minutes where she's just unspooling, like you said, this horrific tale of some dark fucking shit. For a 90s network show, she talks about some dark shit. She talks about child abuse. She talks about kids being killed, babies being murdered. I mean, it's dark.
Her sister was sacrificed at the age of 8.
Yeah, you know, it's fucking dark stuff. And it's, you know, she's had babies that have been buried in the cellar, and it's like, fuck me. But then it's that whole thing of, again, the uncertainty about false memory. I really like the moment where she runs out after the pig, and it's Mulder who goes after her, and he says, "You're remembering." And I thought to myself, he would totally do that. He would totally think repressed memory is a sign of trauma, because he's been through that himself. I like it. It's very subtle, but it's there. You know, he recognises those signs straight away. But it's that whole idea of playing with what's real and what's not this episode. And her memories, it's left ambiguous, isn't it, as to whether a lot of it's true?
Well, it gets explained by her dad at the end, kind of, where he kind of comes clean, but he still says that they did shit to her. But he doesn't say exactly what shit. He says there was never anything sexual. They did include the children in the rituals, which in itself is like, oh, we included them in the rituals, and then we kind of we hypnotized them into forgetting. And you're kind of going, well, that's fucked up as enough as it is, regardless of whether you didn't, you know, sexually abuse your kids or bloodlet them or use them as incubators for babies you were going to sacrifice. Just including your children in your world and then making them forget about it because you knew it was fucked up. In the first place, you wouldn't do that if you didn't know it was fucked up.
Again, it's memory. It's playing with perception. It's playing with those ideas. And the mum, who then, when they go and they tell, obviously, Jim and his wife, Barbara, about what Shannon has said, and, you know, they're distraught.
Yeah.
She then, the mum turns around when Scully asks her, you know, about her sister being sacrificed to eight years. And mum says, no, she died when she was 8 weeks in cot death. So you've got that. That may not have happened with her sister, but it's not to say that she didn't have babies, or she didn't have at least one baby that was killed. It's there's still that level of ambiguity. You don't quite know. You know they've done some weird dark shit, but there could be a mix, couldn't they? Could be part of what Paddock is putting in her head to stir the shit, but then also the reality. I really like that. I really like that. There's a lot going on in this episode about that, about perception, about what people think, and that hysteria again, that panic in a small town of some incredible darkness that might exist, you know, within, you know, it's telling that the Aubreys, they live in this very grand sort of white house in the middle of this beautiful middle class neighbourhood.
Yeah.
And then in their cellar, they've got like Satan rituals going on.
Yeah, and they're red walls and shit. Like, because that's what she says, that kind of makes you think, second guess it as well, because she describes their basement as having red painted walls. And then when Mulder gets a warrant to go down into it later on, he finds the red painted walls. And you're kind of going, well, how much of that was true and how much of it wasn't, you know? Yeah.
And there's little moments where, you know, he tests it. Like when I love it when Scully's being quite, you know, sympathetic with the mother, and then Mulder goes into the kitchen and he goes, "Did you do it?"
Yeah. And the guy breaks the glass. Off. Did you do it?
He's not fucking about.
Like, smashes the glass in his hand, and he's like, "Yeah, yeah,
yeah." But then you have the weird little moments, like the basement door flying closed of its own accord, as if to emphasize the fact that Jim has some serious weird shit flying around, and then he tries to then pass it back on the FBI. He says to Mulder, doesn't he? He says, "How do I know you didn't put those stuff in my daughter's head? How do I know that the FBI can be trusted and you're not?"
Yeah, he says, "Like, was it Satan wears many guises?" And he goes, "Yeah, that sounds like something a Satanist would say to throw off the scent or something."
But how ironic is it that Mulder is now being considered the conspirator? That doesn't happen very often, does it?
No.
And it strikes you when you watch this, and you think, "No way!" You're like, Mulder and Scully are considered the enemy here. They're considered to be the people who are in on this big occult cover-up, which is, you know, hilarious, really, when you think about it. It's just that whole twist. It really, I suppose, it's when Shannon dies that it starts to really push them into the area that the episode ends up going, isn't it? When Paddock's doing her a creepy hand over the candle.
Yeah, the growly. And I think you can hear the skin sizzling at the start of it as well. When she starts using Shannon's necklace and stuff to kind of control her. And even like you said earlier on, she never used any of it against Mulder and Scully, but she did use Scully to kind of trick Mulder away from the dad so she could go and sort him out.
She uses them and the fear about that against them. Yeah, definitely. It's she uses the trope of one, Scully often calling Mulder up, going, "Mulder, help me, I'm in danger," like we've seen a lot of in the past. And you kind of almost expect that to be the case. You know, if you'd been watching at this point, the amount of time Scully's been in the shit and he's had to come and rescue her, which it was a bit of a groan-worthy thing in the first season, they play with that nicely, because then when he turns up and she's like, "No, I'm fine. What's wrong?"
Out of, like, it's not nothing at all related to X-Files, but it reminds me of that scene from the National Lampoon's Fully Loaded where Emilio Estevez's character is breaking in, trying to get into the house because he thinks Samuel L. Jackson's character is in trouble. And he just breaks into the toilet and he's like, "You okay?" And he's just taking a shit.
I love that film. Yeah. That film is amazing. But at the same time now, you've got the whole sort of... This is where the atmosphere of the episode comes into play really well, and what Manners does really well, in that you've got this storm now outside. You've got literal thunder and light. It becomes a Hammer horror house.
Yeah.
House horror eventually. You know, it's set at night. There's a thunderstorm going on. Wind is blowing. Power outages all over the place. And set against that, you've got this whole... The whole thing of Jim now starting to lose his faith in what they've been doing, based on the fact that they all turn around and say, "Just blame it all on Shannon. Blame it all on your daughter. Like, she, you know, we can get rid of the FBI. We can do it all again. We can start, you know, praying properly to the evil one and, you know, sort all this out." And then he can't do that. He's at the point now where he started to realise just how fucked up this whole thing is. And he can't, he loses his faith, which is great. I mean, that's a really good character arc he's got all the way through. And Dan Butler's a great actor anyway. You know, he's always really good when he crops up in TV shows. And I think he plays this arc that Jim has of this really redemptive arc. Not that he's a hero in any sense of the word, but he has this element of redemption before he's killed. And in fact, it's his redemption that gets him killed, isn't it? Really.
It is. And it's like, I mean, you see him out of all the characters in that episode, he's the one struggling with everything. Like, at the start, he's the one who initiates the praying at the very start of the episode as part of the meeting. But as the episode goes on, he's the one that's asking the questions. Every time the four of them meet up, he's the one that initiates the questions. He's like, "Well, what's this? Why is this happening? Why did any of you do this? Or, you know, this is not in ways with, like, the way we're doing things now. We're not sacrificing people. We're not killing anyone. You know, and then he's questioning why this is happening to his daughter. Who's doing this to her? And then when she dies, he then questions their actual full message. Is it the right message for him? Even though he laughs at the hypocrisy of Catholicism and Christianity, and he believes that the way that they've always gone about things was the proper way, because it was meant to be. They did it to keep themselves prosperous and self-serving, and they, you know, they worship because it actually got them somewhere in life, whereas they find that every other religion that he sees is not about getting people their just desserts, whereas ironically he does end up getting his just desserts at the end.
It's that I think that whole scene, that whole sort of confession scene to Mulder in the basement, is fascinating, because it is talking about the underlying themes as to why these people worship. You know, I mean, you think about it, why would you worship Satan? What's the point of that? You know, what do you, I mean, at the beginning, I think Mulder, when they're talking about the the links to the sort of anti-Semitism. Scully pulls out that, you know, connection to like a newspaper in the 30s.
Yeah.
And Mulder talks about how, you know, the Church of Satan and Wicca, they've renounced these kind of practices. Even they've renounced these kind of practices years ago. So you think to yourself, if you're a genuine pure Satanist, what are you doing it for? You know, the whole, it goes back to the whole idea, I suppose, of like making a deal, literal deal with the devil. And in occult mythology, it's the whole thing of, you know, it's like the crossroads idea, isn't it? Where you sell your soul to the devil and you get endless riches, or you get like everything you want in life suddenly. But these people, like you said, they've got this very self-serving idea that's against the idea of Christianity and Catholicism, which is all about, you know, stripping away all the materialism you've got in order to be very pure and, you know, worship and be sacrifice everything. These people want to get more. They want to live in that big white beautiful house and have money. And it's really interesting. It's fascinating. And what I love about this episode is that they managed to tap all that into everything while still telling the story. They never lose sight of the fact you've got a rollicking horror tale going on here. And I think that's what's clever, because that's big weighty themes, aren't they? They're dealing with.
They are. I mean, and it's done in such a way that it still keeps the feel of a Monster of the Week story, but it also has some darkness to it as well. And they keep, as you said, they keep the themes going, because it doesn't let up. It's like there's no real lull. Like for the 45 minutes it goes on for, there's no lull in where it's going with the story. It's constantly moving forward. There's no scenes that are just there for filler. Every scene matters that they're in. Like,
yeah, the pacing is tight. You know, it's spot on. It's bang, bang, bang. It never lets up. And I think the ultimate darkness comes, you know, after Jim shackles off his previous beliefs, and you get the whole you get the great line from Mulder where he says, you know, you must have known what you were doing. Did you really think you could call up the devil and ask him to behave? Which sums up this episode.
That's a great line. So good. Yeah, it's a really, really good line.
And it's such a Mulder thing to say, because Mulder would totally believe. Actually, funnily enough, the irony is I don't know if Mulder does believe in the devil, because he doesn't really believe in God. So there's that interesting thing in that whether Mulder believes in demons or Satanism, I don't necessarily think he does, but I think he believes in that they've done something and summoned something. They don't get really into the religious side of things with Mulder yet. That comes later in more of the Scully religious episodes, I think, but because this is more of a straightforward horror. But it's that the ultimate darkness of this is what happens to Jim and the way he dies, which is obviously being eaten by that snake, which, I mean, it's a wonder they get away with it in a way, because it is, in one respect, it's really daft, but on the other respect, the snake is a classic sort of demon symbol, isn't it? It's a classic sort of,
well, it's, if you notice, it's on the school crest.
Oh, is it really?
Yeah, on the center of the school crest is a snake wrapped around something else. Like, it's a giant snake wrapped around, I think it's a tree or a log or something. But it's the very first image you see in the episode. It's the school crest. And it's a snake that's wrapped around it. And it was all foreboding for how he eventually goes.
I didn't notice that. That's a brilliant spot, Wayne. That's cool. Yeah, a little, nice little bit of visual foreshadowing there. But, you know, you've got, at the same time as you've got, like, Jim being eaten by the snake, you've got Paddock, who's there with the snake eyes. As you go, and then you see the snake reptilian eyes.
Yeah, and it just focuses on those eyes.
And it's an obvious visual thing to make the point, yeah, this is Paddock. This snake is Paddock. It's not a random snake. It is a demon snake, obviously. It's all part of the trick. You know, this is the point where Mulder rushes off to save Scully, even though she doesn't need saving. They get back, and you've just got a pile of bones. And that really chills me out as well. The fact there's just this pile of bones there. And
yeah.
It's another thing that Scully surely wouldn't be able to, you know, she just say that a python would take weeks to eat a man. It's like, well, look at that. There was a man here like half an hour ago.
And the snake skin is sitting there as well. You're kind of going, all the signs are here.
Yeah, come on, Scully. This is obviously weird and this isn't normal. But yeah, she's still saying, I don't know. You know, it's strange. In the end, it's the link to reach Paddock, because they start to then, well, what's great is when they get, they're in the school and Paddock is pretending to be an injured.
Yeah.
The actress, Susan, I think her name's Blomert, I don't quite know how to pronounce her surname, but she's great. She's so good in this, because she can play that sort of sweet old lady.
The unassuming kind of, like, you know, you don't expect her to be the villains. Like, it's just out of the blue. You're like, what? But even though the whole time we're like, she's the bad guy, she's the bad guy. It's not these plebs.
The evil is staring you in the face. This is the beautiful thing about it all. It's staring them in the face all the way through. And there's even little hints, like when Scully does a background, he's doing a background check on Paddock. That's the whole thing she's doing when he's with Jim. And, you know, there's little things like how the teacher who would normally teach them had, like, necrotizing fleshitis.
Yeah.
That's very... And they say that's very rare. And he's like, come on, it's obvious. And she does even say, oh, maybe Paddock's it. No, I'm being hysterical. She even turns around and says, puts it down to suspecting Paddock as being hysteria.
Yeah.
Which I thought was good. Because you would suspect her, wouldn't you? I mean, that, at that point, you surely would think... She just turned up out of the blue. People have started to die.
And she will be the prime suspect, but every single time they see her, she's like got a sob story, or she's got a decent enough alibi. Well, I was locked in that room over there, or I heard her scream and I came in, or, oh, I've got blood on my nose. They beat me up and they've gone that way. You know, it's like, it's literally just pure misdirection at its finest.
But she plays a beautiful con with it, though, doesn't she? Because when they find her and she's, you know, she's apparently been hit on the head and she tells them where to go, she goes... It's go to the conference room. They're all there. Like that kind of thing. And then they go off and they have no idea. And then her face just turns to stone.
Yeah.
And you're there going, oh, you're brilliant you are. Because you're just evil. You're just playing them like a fiddle. You get another really iconic shot, I think, as well. When at this point, when they're, before they get captured and hogtied up, there's that scene where they're walking down a corridor. This scene could sum up the X-Files for me, actually. This visual moment where they're walking down the corridor. The lights are out. They've got their torches crossing as they walk towards this door. That, I don't know about you, that's the X-Files to me. That's a perfect visual.
It is. That image has been reused so many times in any kind of promotional material. And I even used it myself recently for something I was technically involved in. You know the Storybreaker guys?
Yeah, was this the Flight 8? Oh, what's it called? Flight 8? Yeah, the poster you did. Yeah.
I drew up their poster for them, and I used that very, very similar thing where I had two floodlights that just crossed over as an X, as a part of the poster design. And it was used again. It was used for, I don't know, it was one of the movies used it as well. The second film, I think, could have been.
Yeah, I think they did. Yeah, I want to believe, yeah.
I mean, is this the first time that's been used?
I think it's the first time it's used in that way. I think there are moments where they use torches. I think maybe in Squeeze they did a little bit of that as well way back in season one. But I think this is the first time you see it in that way, really.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a great visual. Sidebar, everyone, but go and check out the Storybreakers episode, Flight... Is it 813? I can't remember the
something
name.
Something like that, or 183, or something along those lines.
Yeah, and it's the original script that was written for the X-Files that didn't become an episode, but became the film Final Destination, which Morgan and Wong went on to direct.
Yeah, they directed it. Wong directed it, yeah.
Yeah. So they loved that script. They took it on and made it into the movie we all know and the franchise we all know. So, the Storybreakers guys do a script read of that, and it's great. I have listened to that. It's really well put together. It's really good. So go and check that out, guys, because it's wicked. And Wayne's artwork is ace as well.
Nice.
So, yeah, obviously, at this point, they get knocked out by the PTA guys, and this is such a great ending. Mark Snow's music is awesome as well, because he's got this real... satanic, you know, chanting going on while they're just being dragged. And it's what I thought, I don't know if you noticed this, but it's one of the few times where they're both in the shit. Usually it's either Mulder or Scully, and one of them has to come and save the other. In this case, they're both fucked, they're both tied up, they've got guns on them, and you think, how are they going to get out of this?
And that was the beautiful thing about it, because technically, even though you think they're, again, it's all kind of misdirection. You think they're in the shit, but they're not, because the whole time, Paddock is controlling the main guy who's like saying, we got to kill these fuckers. We got to kill them. And like, you know, this will be the sacrifice that will set our gods right. And, you know, we'll be left prosperous after this. And he's the one that's been controlled by Paddock the whole time, because she stole his keys and she's like using them to control him. And he just basically... Yeah, Mulder and Scully were never in any danger because they were never the ones that Paddock was after.
No, exactly. And she saves their life. In effect, she sets them up to be in danger, but then she saves their life in a twisted kind of way, which is brilliant. And she says, doesn't she, the last time you see her, when great shot of the thunder and the lightning and you see her in shadow and she says, it is already too late.
Yeah.
And then when you see her in shadow, and that's it. And then, oh, I tell you what, the last moment of this is one of my favourite moments of all time in the X-Files. It's one of those classic final holy shit moments where you get chills, where they get into the classroom and you've got her final message left etched on the chalkboard, which is, goodbye, it's been nice working with you.
Yeah.
Lights go up. Everything's back to normal now. Like,
storm's gone.
And they just left. I love it when they're both just... It reminded me of the episode Blood, where at the end, Mulder gets that message on his phone that says, all done, bye-bye, and he's just left to stare at his phone and go, who the fuck was that?
Yeah.
And it's this whole thing where they just both look at each other and go, who the fuck was she? Yeah. and you're thinking that as well. You're thinking, oh my God. Like, it's just, I don't know about you, chills. Chills.
And it was meant to be as well. That was, as you said before, it was Wong and Morgan's last episode. And that was meant to be also a little goodbye from them as series regulars.
It's a great little in-joke, which also works as a beautiful final twisted, you know, little message.
Yeah.
Because as you say, she has been working with them all through it. She's been working actually to wreak vengeance upon these, you know, these heathens effectively. So in some twisted way, she has been working with them both. that's the weird, mad thing about it. And yeah, I would have just loved to have been in the car afterwards with Mulder and Scully, where Scully's going, What just happened, Mulder? And he'd be like, oh, God. Well, she was obviously a demon, Scully. Obviously, she was a demon. It's just, I think the climax of this episode is just great. I think it's so good. It just ends in such a blisteringly, you know, good way. It just never lets up, as you say. So, yeah, it's a great way to end what I think is a great episode. So, yeah, it's been fun to talk about that one.
Did the others kill Jerry Stevens? Shannon?
No.
But you are responsible. You knew the possibilities contained in your beliefs no matter how watered down. Did you really think you could call up the devil and ask him to behave?
Before you go, though, Wayne,
yeah?
You have got a quiz. You have got a quiz because you actually requested one, which...
Yeah, because you messaged me saying, I don't know if we're going to do the quiz. I was like, oh, I like the quizzes.
Yeah, but so many people don't.
Like, oh, okay.
So I naturally assume now... that nobody would want a quiz. So when you said, yeah, I'll have a quiz, I was like, oh, great. I get to do a quiz. Brilliant. So.
Now, I might do crap at it. Like, I'm not saying I'm going to do well, but, you know.
I can't, because I'm crap at keeping track of the scores, but can you remember what you got in any of your last episodes?
Oh, I think the highest I got was like 3 out of 5 or something. I did all right, but I didn't do great.
That's not bad. Well, let's see then. Let's see. I've got four questions and a quote for you. So let's see how you do on Die Handyverletzt. So here we go. Question one. You may get this one because I think you mentioned it earlier. Which play are the PTA meeting concerned has the F word?
Greece.
Greece. Yeah, you got that one. But I'd done the question before you talked about it, so I thought, I'm not taking that off. You can get a point there. Question two then. What track does Mulder offer as devil music after the sheriff mentions it?
He says something like Death in Chicago or something.
Ah, oh, you know, I'm tempted to give you that. The Night Chicago Died.
Night Chicago Died, that's it, yeah. Night Chicago Died.
That's close enough. You can have that one.
Thank you.
Question three. Can you name the Nazi newspaper? This is a bit trickier. Can you name the Nazi newspaper Scully pulls the report from?
No, I can't. I know for a fact. I can't. I'm not even going to try... I could end up, you know, framing somebody, but
you could, but you'd probably pronounce it better than I've pronounced the title all through the episode. Let's be honest.
I can't remember. I can't remember.
I'll tell you, it's Volkischer Biobacter, and I've probably said that wrong. But there you go. That was a tricky one. Question four then: where does Shannon's class go on a trip? When she's talking in the monologue, she talks about how they went on a trip. Where did they go? Now it has a British connection in a way. If that rings a bell, that's a clue.
They went to the American Stonehenge.
Yes, the American Stonehenge, which I'm curious about because I like Stonehenge. Question five, then the quote. Okay, so if you can name who said it and when would be good. So here we go. You really do watch the Learning Channel.
Mulder says it to Scully when she's talking about how long it takes a python to digest a human.
Yeah. You really, even in that dark situation, he's got a one-liner. You really do watch The Learning Channel, Scully. Well, you know what? I think you may have got top score there in your three, because that's four out of five, Wayne. That's pretty good.
Yeah, happy with that. Yeah. Glad I said this to a quiz.
Yeah. If it wasn't for my devious Nazi question, you'd have got full marks. You'd have been at the top.
Bloody Nazis.
So yeah, okay, that brings us to the end of Die Handyverletzt. I can stop butchering the title now and let everyone get on with their day. This was great fun to go through, Wayne. So it's been really great to have you back on the show. So thanks for coming back on.
Yeah, man, that was good fun. I enjoyed that. Thanks.
So you'll be back for a season 3 episode, hopefully, all going to plan. So until you're back on the show, where can people find what you're up to, the kind of things you mentioned earlier?
The Irish Pubcast is the podcast that I'm involved in. You can find us on Geek Planet Online. Or on iTunes. Our Facebook page was also just Irish Pubcast. We're on Twitter as well as The Irish Pubcast. You can also find me personally on Twitter, just Wayne Talbot. And yeah, if you're in Ireland, you'll find me at KCon, which is happening in the first weekend in April. And then I'll be at Dublin Comic Con on the 12th and 13th of August. Yeah, I think that's pretty much all I have planned at the moment. And yeah, and my book, the graphic novel, The Broke, will be released at Dublin Comic Con in August.
That's pretty great. That's all great stuff. You know, I know I'm pretty sure we do have some Irish listeners, you know, with yourself coming on the show and people like Darren Mooney and stuff like that. So, yeah, guys, if you are in Ireland, get to all this stuff because it's ace. We don't know. I don't have anything nearly this cool going on in Birmingham where I live. It's rubbish. Well, check all that stuff out, guys, because it's great. And check us out, as I said earlier, on Twitter, The Xcast, The X_cast even. And we're on Facebook, the page, The Xcast page, the group, the Facebook podcast group. Look it up. There's loads of stuff going on. And as I said, leave us a review on iTunes. That'd be brilliant. Yeah, so it'll be great to get you back on, Wayne, down the line. Good luck with it all. Hope it all goes well this year.
Cheers.
And we'll be back very soon for a brand new episode. But until that time, remember the classic words, trust no one. The Xcast is produced and presented by Tony Black, part of the Black Hole Media podcast network. Title music is courtesy of Will A, who you can find on Twitter at I Am Will A Y E.